I'm always slightly nervous when I get introduced as the person who teaches preaching before I'm about to stand up and preach, because it kind of raises the stakes a bit too high. But anyway, we'll see what we can do. I've been given as the topic, 21st century preaching, is preaching an out-of-date means of communication? Very happy with that topic, because that is a particular interest of mine. And some of the things I want to say to you have been as a result of 20-odd years as a practitioner, learning from my own mistakes, but also in recent years, my own interest in listening to a lot of preachers and trying to work out what it is that good preachers do well to gain your attention. Regrettably, the sad caricature of the sermon is a sort of an empty, incomprehensible droning from a cleric who stands 6 feet above contradiction. This is amusingly portrayed, or painfully portrayed, in one of the Mr. Bean sketches, which you may have seen, where Mr. Bean goes to church, and he is completely bemused by the whole event, and he's doing what I guess we all do when we're a visitor in the church, trying to watch what everybody else is doing, when to stand up and when to sit down. And he sits down, and the vicar stands up and starts droning wordlessly in the background. And Mr. Bean does everything he can to stay awake, and all the tricks that we do, sort of go like that and poking ourselves and whatever. And then, of course, eventually he is completely fast asleep on the floor and prostrate. But unfortunately, that's often the sort of caricature of preaching. It's the time for a quick nap. I heard a story about somebody who said that they judged the sermon by how far they managed to get mentally around the golf course. And if they got the 18th hole, then the sermon was far too long. But the oft-quoted caricature of preaching is a monstrous monologue by a moron to mutes. And hopefully, neither of those caricatures, either to mutes or from a moron this morning, will hold sway, because I'm hoping that you're going to speak to me in a moment in the question time as well. Now, my particular area of research that has resulted in this forthcoming book on preaching is because I sent around a survey, to those who were training at my theological college, Wycliffe Hall, those who I knew in the various networks I was involved in, and basically anybody else on my email address list. And I asked this question: who is your most favourite preacher and why? Very simple. And tried to elicit from people not so much a detailed theological critique of why they like certain preachers or not, but why is it that some preachers manage to gain our attention, and when they preach, the time flies by, we feel as though we've met in the presence of God, and that there's really been a connection. Trying to get a sense, really, of what it was that good preachers do well. And of course, particularly I'm interested in that question now, in 2011, because preaching has changed. Like many people, I'm able to go online, I'm able to click on Mark Driscoll's website and to listen to him. If I've got an hour to spare, he never preaches for less than an hour, or Rico Trice, or any of the people we've already mentioned this morning. And in fact, those two people both feature in my book as examples, different examples of good preaching. And how does that relate, really, to what I hear week by week in the church? And how can I raise my expectations and encourage the preachers in my congregation? What should I be looking for in their preaching? And to summarise, some of the things that people told me attracted them to certain preachers included things like this. Taking the ancient truth and applying it to the modern world, being aware of the cultural and philosophical challenges to the ancient gospel message, inspiring people with a passion of God's glory and his goodness, letting the Bible speak with simplicity and clarity, using humour well, engaging not only with the head but also with the heart, applying the message, making much of Jesus Christ, persuading people by your passionate arguments from the Bible, and so on. That was the list of some of the things that people appreciate in good preaching. And no one person is probably able to do all of that in an exemplary fashion every time, but there are some of the things that we look for. So if I were to try and encourage you to both have a high expectation out of preaching, and also to see that it is something that's still relevant in a multimedia electronic age where communication works so differently, what are some of the things that I would want to say to you about preaching? Well, the first thing is this, and I'll use an illustration. I was on a bus in London more than 20 years ago, and I say, give you the time scale, because I have to point out that it was just before I was married, before I had any children, which gives you the context of the illustration. And I was sitting on a bus, and about three rows in front of me was a young mother with a squawking baby. And the baby was causing a little bit of disruption in the bus carriage and making a heck of a racket, and all of us were getting slightly irritated by the noise. And the mother rummaged into her bag, and she came out with a Farley's Rusk. And I thought, phew, at last, you know, a little bit of peace. And if that had been me, I'd have taken that rust and I'd have rammed it in the baby's mouth as soon as possible just to get the din to go away. But of course, being so much wiser, the mother, and hopefully a little bit further down the road, maybe I might simply be as well, what she did is she put the rusk in the baby's hand, and then of course the baby took the rusk to its mouth and chewed on it. Now, I use that slightly trivial illustration to illustrate, in a sense, what the preacher's job is. Because our job as preachers is not to ram the Bible down people's throats, as the caricature often says, but actually to put an open Bible in people's hands. So the people who inspire me as preachers are those who enabled me to go away to look at the passage from the Bible that was explained and applied, and to actually see the truth that is there and apply it to my own life. In that respect, you know, part of the gift of preaching is not that we're just sort of spoon-fed, but actually that the Bible is opened up so that it becomes a book that's accessible to us and feeds us. The other striking thing about preaching is that although, you know, I have been for much of my working life a jobbing clergyman, where preaching was part of the mandatory essentials to my Sunday work, one which I relished and enjoyed, I wonder if you ever considered the fact that actually that God is the first preacher. If you were to go back to that Bible reading that we have at most of our Christmas services from John 1, 1 to 18, where the passage begins by saying, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. To describe the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God, the language used is of a God who communicates. And there's conscious echoes in John chapter 1 with Genesis chapter 1. How did God bring this world into being? Little refrain all the way through Genesis chapter 1 is, and God said, through speech, through his speaking, he spoke the world into being. And as John reflects upon that, he sees that the action of God is tied up in his speech. In the beginning was the Word. This Word made the world. And this Word became flesh, dwelt among us. We have seen his glory, full of grace and truth. And it concludes that section in John 1, verse 18, with these words. No one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. He has made him known. And there's an interesting little word there in John 1, verse 18. And the word is, the word from which we get the English word, exegesis, exegete. In other words, he has made him known. He has interpreted him. He has preached him. He's exegeted him. The way that we know the invisible God is through the spoken word, the Word made flesh, who makes the Father known. And so as I quite often say to my students, God had only one son and he made him a preacher. So it's a high calling and an important job, not least because God continues to make himself known through the preaching of his word. So what is it then that good preachers should be doing? Now, some good preachers have an ability to say old things in fresh and new ways. Novelty is actually castigated quite strongly in the Bible. I haven't got anything to say to you that God hasn't already said. And in fact, if I say something that God hasn't already said, you probably should be walking out from here now anyway. I have a responsibility to teach this Bible faithfully. But nevertheless, if you sat under any preaching for any time, then it's quite hard to hear it with freshness. One of the people who has had a great influence upon my appreciation of preaching has been Dick Lucas. Some of you will know who he is. He was the many decades the rector of St. Helen's Church, Bishopsgate, in the Square Mile in the city. And when I went there as a junior staff member in my early 20s, it was stunning for me to see all of these city gents pouring in on a Tuesday lunchtime to hear a sermon for 20 minutes in the middle of their day by Dick Lucas. And one of Dick's unique abilities was his ability to take you to a passage of the Bible and to enable you to see old truths in new ways. I can remember vividly a sermon that he preached on John 3:16. John 3:16 you probably know very well. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. It's probably the most famous and best known verse in the Bible. And I can still remember Dick standing up in the pulpit and saying, my text this lunchtime is from John 3:16, and he read the text. And he said, this is probably the most famous verse in the Bible, but the problem is we don't believe it. Well, that certainly got my attention. And he went on to say, we know this verse so very well, but generally speaking, we don't believe that Jesus is God's unique Son. And we don't believe that if you don't believe in him, you will perish forever. And what he did was, to me, very faithfully and very helpfully, was to talk about the two things in this passage, the uniqueness of Jesus Christ and his unique means way of salvation. But he said it in such a way that it got my attention. I didn't fall asleep during that sermon, because actually he brought old truths to life through the way in which he applied that text. If you follow the Christian media at all, you may have been aware that an American preacher by the name of Rob Bell has written a book, which was just released a couple of weeks ago, entitled Love Wins. Rob Bell is an interesting, unique guy. He has a congregation of over 10,000 members. And has anybody here come across the Numa DVDs? Is that something that's entered into the church here? So he makes these stunning, visually compelling, short DVDs in which he talks to direct the camera and speaks very eloquently and helpfully, implying Bible passages. Anyway, I won't go into the controversy over Rob Bell. In fact, if you get the Church of England newspaper, I've got an article about him coming out next Friday. But one of the things that is very skillful, and I hope that he's not undone the good work that he has previously done by his new book, is he is able to weave in a story about common incidences. So in the Numa DVDs, he will speak about what it's like to make a fire and to feel the warmth of it. He'll speak about walking in the hills and with his young son in his backpack on the back and being caught in a storm and how he has to comfort his son. And he uses lots of very ordinary, everyday illustrations and tells a story that encompasses the retelling of the gospel. And again, I think good preachers do that kind of thing. They tell the old, old story, as we say, in a way that resonates with my experience of life and enables me to see the connections and to apply it. Sometimes, of course, also, the preacher may bring insights into the text I hadn't seen before. Yes, it's helpful to take me to texts that I know very well and to see it from a fresh angle, but actually to take me to a text and to see something there I never saw before, as long as it is there, of course, can be very helpful. And I first learned that particular lesson in a Greek class when I was at Oak Hill 25 years ago. And my Greek teacher taught me something from the Greek, which excited me, at least for a short time, to work hard on the original languages. So in John chapter 21, you'll remember that Jesus has risen from the dead, but he's still appearing to the disciples. And many of the disciples are still smarting from their own failure. They're not all completely convinced about what's going on. And Peter in particular, somewhat impulsively says, right, you know, I'm off fishing. Man after my own heart. And so he goes, they fish all night, they catch nothing, and Jesus tells them, with echoes of his original call to Peter, to cast the net on the right side of the boat. They make a great haul, and Peter jumps into the lake and recognizes who it is. And then it tells you, then halfway through John 21, they get back to land, and they discover that Jesus had already lit a fire, put some fish on it, and now he's going to talk to Peter about his relationship with him and ask him three times, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Now, the little insight into the text that is very helpful to me is that where it says in John 21, verse 9, that there was a charcoal fire, on it was some fish and some bread. And that word, charcoal fire, is a very unique word in the New Testament. It only occurs one other place. Now, I wonder whether you can guess where that one other place is in John's Gospel, in the other Gospels as well. The word for fire is the fire that you roast chestnuts on if you're in the West End. You know, it's that sort of charcoal fire with the plate for cooking on the top. And the only other place where that word is used is when Peter is standing around warming his hands by a fire as Jesus has been tried, and three times he denies him. And the thing that was insightful for me about just getting that resonance is that with a little bit of knowledge of Greek here, you can see that John is making a connection between that occasion when he vehemently denied Jesus, having just warmed his hands on this fire, and now Jesus evocatively takes him back to the smell of burning charcoal, stands around the fire again, and three times asks him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And so that little insight into the text helps you connect that Jesus has taken to the place of denial in order that he can call him again to reaffirm his love of Christ. So giving new insights into the text is very helpful. A.W. Tozer, who is an author some of you I'm sure would have heard of and may have read, said this, that truth engages the citadel of the human heart, and it is not satisfied until it has conquered everything there. And so God's word, as it is read and particularly as it is preached, is doing the business, if you like, of not just titillating our imaginations, not just telling us exciting and interesting things, but actually bringing us back to a place where we too can meet with the living God. And in order to do that, in order to ensure that we've understood the text, that we've preached it, and that we've applied it well, there are a number of things that the preacher needs to do. John Stott memorably talks about the fact of living in two worlds, the preacher, as it were, connecting the world of the ancient text, taking you back 2,000 years to the New Testament, or even further back into the Old Testament, and connecting that ancient world with our modern world. And so the good preacher will, as it were, cross over that bridge and back again in order to ensure that we've entered the ancient world to see what the message said then and applied it to today as well. And that means, therefore, that good preachers will constantly, if you like, have those two horizons in view. As Karl Barth famously said, that you read the New Testament with the New Testament in one hand and with the newspaper in the other hand. So that we're actually making links between the two worlds and at the same time. And I don't know about you, but if the preacher standing up the front is not actually connected with my world early on in that sermon, then I'm going to find it difficult to get that excited about the exposition of that particular text. We're constantly crossing the bridge to make those two worlds join together. But the preacher also has to realize that this is a message which they are a steward of, they have responsibility to discharge it faithfully, and there is a summons not from the preacher, but actually from God. And that if we are faithfully preaching the Bible message, then there should just be that sense that the voice we're hearing is not the droning of the preacher, but actually God himself making a challenge to people's lives. And that should make preachers urgent. Sense of responsibility that the message that we preach actually demands a response from people. Billy Graham, of course, was in the 50s and 60s well known as the leading evangelist in the world. And I can remember when he came here, and I think it was in the 1970s, for his last big crusade in England, that he was interviewed on a television station by some hard-nosed, cynical reporter, and I don't remember who it was. And he looked at Billy Graham and said, look, you come all the way from America, and you're preaching to these great big crowds, but really your message is very simple. Why do you preach the message again and again, you must be born again? And I can well remember Billy Graham eyeballing the interview, and he said, my friend, I preach the message, you must be born again. My friend, because you must be born again. You would never miss an opportunity. Here he was on national television, and he's not going to pull his punches and make sure that on every occasion the truth is explained. Not so that it'll titillate our imagination, but actually rather so that it will preach for a verdict. Paul similarly was urgent in this task. He said at the end of 2 Corinthians 5, we are ambassadors for Christ, God making his appeal through us. We implore you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. For our sake he made him to be sin, who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. There was an urgency, therefore, to Paul's message, and there should be to the preacher as well. He went on, at the beginning of chapter 6, to say, behold, now is the favourable time. Now is the day of salvation. Don't put it off. And there should just be a sense that we shouldn't go out of church thinking, well, that was interesting, I quite enjoyed that, and I stayed awake through most of it. There should be a sense in which it has an urgency, a nowness. This is a message that even today I need to respond to. And therefore, good preachers will preach for a verdict, as we sometimes say, looking for people to respond, to mature in the Christian faith, or to become a Christian in the first instance. It was Mark Twain, I think, who said, it's not the bits of the Bible I don't understand that bother me, it's the bits of the Bible I do understand. And what he's pointing out is that, you see, most people don't respond neutrally to the Bible message. The Bible message comes with a force that requires a response. And sometimes our problem is just pure ignorance. In fact, the word agnostic just comes from the Greek word ignorance, so it's not a very complimentary phrase. But actually, we encourage agnostics, people who don't know, to learn what the truth is, and increasingly we're in a post-Christian culture where people don't know what the gospel is, so we need to educate them. But actually, it comes with a moral force as well, and the issue, as Mark Twain points out, is not that I don't always understand the Bible, but it's actually the bits I do understand that make me feel uncomfortable, that demand a change in my life. And good preachers, therefore, are also there with that role. The dominant word for preach, to preach, in the New Testament, is a word that could be translated herald. And that's the picture of the town crier, if you like, going through the town saying, oh yay, oh yay, hear this message from the king. And in that respect, the preacher is, yes, there to have a conversation. Yes, there to explain something to you. But actually, dominantly there is a messenger. A messenger, as Paul said, an ambassador from the king, with an announcement from the king that we should sit up and listen to, and that demands a response. It's not the only picture in the Bible, but it's a dominant one. And therefore, it's right and appropriate that we should respect the preacher who faithfully preaches the word, so that we can hear God's voice through them and respond accordingly. And therefore, we need to learn to listen to preaching. We may not be familiar in our very multimedia age of sitting and hearing somebody speak for 20 odd minutes and us paying attention. And people say to me all the time, surely in the modern age preaching is outdated, you should be using much more video and PowerPoint and much more interaction. I'm not against using any of those things, but there's an awful lot to be said. And in fact, in our modern age, people don't experience it very much. By having eye contact and engagement with people, by actually having a preacher who is able to use their tongue to paint a picture for you, so that you can see what they're saying in your mind's eye, to incite your imagination to grasp the truth. And therefore we need to learn to listen again. As Samuel said, "Speak, Lord, for your servant heareth." That should be our disposition when we preach. And even if it's a bad sermon, if they've opened up a Bible passage, hopefully it'll enable you to engage with the passage that is there and to learn from what they haven't said, maybe even as you learn from what they have said. So maybe that's a slightly disparate group of commendations for preaching. I could go on longer, like any preacher could, as you would imagine. But I hope that what I've been able to do here is to incite your appetite again, to see that preaching should be valued because actually God is the communicator par excellence. And he's commissioned preachers in order to say old things in new ways and to say new things he'd not seen before, to make the connection between the ancient and the modern world, and to do it in such a way that it touches not just our heads but our hearts, compelling us to listen and compelling us to act. Sometimes people say to me, well, I've been coming to church for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 plus years, and I've heard everything before, and I'm not really sure I ever learn anything from the sermons. When I did my survey on what is it that makes you listen to preachers, one wise respondent said that their favourite preacher, and they named a big American preacher because they occasionally went online to listen to them, but he said that in actual fact, the person who nourishes me best week by week is their faithful local preacher. And I want to commend you. Do go to the main convention and listen to Mark Driscoll. I think he's a very good, very compelling preacher. But I also want you to value the relationship you have with your preachers here at Christ Church. The faithfulness of preaching week in, week out, providing you with your daily bread. And I think it's an important point, which I illustrate sometimes like this. Actually, feeding on preaching is rather like feeding on, well, food. We've enjoyed a nice cooked breakfast this morning. And most of us eat three meals a day with countless snacks in between. And sometimes I say to people, you know, I wonder, can you remember what you ate for lunch on Wednesday? Or maybe for breakfast last Saturday when you weren't at a men's breakfast? Feeding on the Bible is rather like that, in a sense that it's essential for our nourishment so that we take in our daily bread. And preaching has part of that role in it, feeding us on God's word week in, week out. And there's something that's essential for our general health, so we eat like that. But of course, some meals stand out, don't they? Maybe a cooked breakfast on a Saturday. Or perhaps that wonderful Chinese meal with friends, or that barbecue in the sunshine, or perhaps your Christmas roast turkey. These aren't the routine meals that we have in order to keep us alive. These are the meals that we ate at leisure, the ones that satisfied your taste, the ones that delighted you, and that satisfy you deeply. And so it is with some sermons. Some sermons stand out. They're very memorable. We feasted on them, and they were changed our life in some way. But my main point, I think, is to say, well, don't devalue the absolute necessity of your daily intake of the Bible for your personal reading and your week-by-week preaching from your congregation members, even if sometimes you're served a veritable feast which stands out. We cannot live on veritable feasts. We actually eat on our daily bread. In fact, Jesus taught us to pray something rather like that. So I think there are an opportunity for you to engage and to ask questions as we come to this next section this morning. But I hope I've at least enthused you a little bit about preaching. I hope I've done my job properly in that respect. I'm very open to however you want to handle the conversation and discussion from here.
Yeah. I have a reputation for starting off these things with a question. it's well attested that people's attention span is often not much more than 10 minutes. And yet, as you will readily accept, many sermons are longer than that. Would it not be better to replace many of them these days with a short, shall we say, homily of about 10 minutes?
Yes, I mean, that is commonly said. And I have to say, generally speaking, I dispute it. Because actually, depends on what model of communication you're using. I went to hear Bill Bailey in Oxford a few months ago, and okay, he did some great musical repartee as well. But basically, he stood on stage for an hour and a half and spoke. Now, I can't compete with that, because he's a master communicator. But I think that it depends on the context in which you're talking. For sometimes, 10 minutes can feel far too long, depending on what the content is and who's giving it. But sometimes I've sat in sermons which have gone on for half an hour and it's felt too short. And I don't want to be unduly intimidated by the idea that the length in itself is what dictates a good or a bad sermon. I think the sort of standard 22.5-minute sermon should not necessarily be the only way in which we communicate. And in fact, when I was a vicar in Wimbledon, depending on the service, you know, we had different length sermons, which I imagine you probably do here. And I still would like to say that there should be something compelling about the live verbal communication in the presence of God that should enable us to preach for a length of time that is required, whatever that length may be. And I think also there are teaching reasons, if you like, as well as preaching reasons, why we have responsibility to do more than just try and teach everything we know about the Christian faith in a very short time on a Sunday. It should be supplemented by teaching in lots of different contexts. If you think, you know, school teachers are the people who quite often come up to me and say, you know, school children's attention is only such and such a time. I say, well, let me tell you, if you had only 10 minutes on a Sunday morning, or if you like, an hour and a quarter on a Sunday service, in order to teach your entire curriculum, how would you manage to get through it all? And there's just a sense in which we need to use all the opportunities that we've got to speak. And I am not entirely convinced by the anecdotal research that we can only listen for 10 minutes. You've actually done quite well, as far as I can tell. I'm a little bit longer already this morning. You're certainly giving a good impression you're listening anyway.
Any other questions? Yes, Scott.
Do you think it takes special anointing to be a preacher, or can virtually anybody be taught to be an effective preacher?
Ah, good question. actually, I didn't bring very many copies, but there are a couple of free materials on here, one of which is the Wycliffe Hall newsletter. And I brought that because, actually, it's got an article in there from me about preaching, because we're setting up a school of preaching at Wycliffe Hall. And one of the questions that I often get asked as a teacher in homiletics at Wycliffe Hall is, can you teach preaching? And the answer is yes and no, insofar as I do believe that the Bible speaks in terms of preaching as being a gift. So, you know, Paul talking to Timothy sort of speaks about the idea of fanning into flame the gift of God upon you. So the idea that the gift is given and that the preacher therefore is anointed in that respect. And some people come out of the spiritual womb speaking, as it were, with that definite gift. But there is clearly also in the pastorals the idea that that needs training and improving and correcting, and even the idea of fanning into flame. What did that mean? How did that gift get fanned into flame? So I don't think I can make somebody a preacher who hasn't got the gift. I can probably help them with verbal communication skills, but I think there are people who've got the gift of preaching who've actually not really, if you like, fanned it into flame. So I do think it's a spiritual gift, but I think that, like many gifts, they actually need practice and training and help.
I thought I might just follow on from that as the curate here, and I preach to you regularly, just to say from my experience that at school I never did any... I think I performed a poem once at school, and that was about it. I had no perception of myself as a public speaker. And I did something called the Cornhill Training Course, and was amazed to find that I came out the other end of it able to preach. So just, you know, as a real life example of someone who's preaching too regularly, I had no sense of that just being a natural gift as a young man.
Any other questions?
Well, this is probably a whole topic in itself, but you've been basing your argument on the assumption that the Bible is true and it's got something to say. Do you want to just unpack a little bit about where you get that assumption?
Well, yes, there probably is another breakfast meeting, isn't it? But I have made a number of assumptions about the Bible. And I also teach hermeneutics, which is biblical interpretation, so I could very happily pontificate on that subject for a while. I think the main thing I would really want to say in this environment is that I would encourage people to sort of suck and see, as it were, with the Bible, insofar as leaving aside any arguments you may or may not have about eyewitness accounts, how the Bible's written, is it divinely inspired, etc., etc. Obviously, I could speak at length on that. But my main challenge to people is actually just take it and read it. On the table there was a book that I wrote last year on John's Gospel, and the reason why I wrote on John is because John is my favourite Gospel, if I'm allowed to have a favourite. And John is the Gospel that I first read from start to finish when somebody challenged me to sort of actually read it as it stood. And I found that as I did that, that Jesus came alive to me, that I met him, as it were, through the pages of the Bible. So leaving aside any philosophical arguments we might want to make about whether the Bible's true and how it speaks, my first challenge would be to people is to say, go and read it as it is. For sure, you need help with the reading, but we don't generally speaking tend to sort of just dip into other books and take out isolated phrases now and again and stick them up on our mirror or something like that. We tend to take books and paragraphs and phrases and chapters as a whole, and encouraging people to read whole books of the Bible, start with a gospel like Mark or John, is a really good place to start. But yeah, we'll perhaps save the rest for another time.
You have another question?
May I have another one? Fastball for you. Do you think women should preach?
Yes. Well, not all of them. Not all at the same time. But that was a fast response. I mean, yes, I do think, without going too far into the complexities of that argument, I do think that Paul seems to assume that women have verbal ministry in the New Testament, particularly in their understanding of what prophesying means in the Corinthian context. Now, obviously, there are issues which you have to grapple with over authority in the pastoral epistles. But I, for one, am very happy to train, as I do at Wigan Hall, men and women for preaching ministries. I often think that women and men do preach differently, and I think we do well to recognise that we're wired differently. I have a very good friend, former staff member at Oak Hill, actually, a very good friend who preaches, and we've had conversations together, and she preaches very differently. She preaches much more empathetically than me. Now, again, you have to be careful about saying anything that's deemed to be too caricature related to men and women. But I do think that men and women bring different gifts to the table in preaching.
In most other walks of life these days, we would have a measurement system in place so that we could evaluate the performance of a person. And most of those measurements would be there to hopefully improve the yield or improve the performance. We tend not to use that measurement system. The American megachurches use it. But what do you think about? And what metrics would you use?
Yeah, very interesting question. To which there's two completely unrelated responses. One is, I think there is a place for that kind of evaluation. One of the things I've introduced since I've taken over this job at Wycliffe Hall is actually a combination of tutor evaluation of students, but also peer-to-peer evaluation. So actually students go out and preach in teams and give one another feedback. And I do encourage them to continue that when they go into ministry. When I was vicar in Wimbledon, I'd send around surveys around the congregation fairly randomly just to get feedback from people. It's actually a very depressing experience, I have to say, because you have to actually help people understand what they're responding to, not I didn't like that story sort of thing. I think there is a place for that. But equally and oppositely, I would say that it's quite hard to know what you're trying to evaluate, because some of the people who've affected my life the most as preachers have actually not fulfilled very many of the things that I've just told you about. But other things have happened. One is that God has used them to say things in an unexpected way that I wasn't ready for and didn't see that fast ball coming. Or something about their prayerfulness, their godliness, their care of me and all the rest of it has communicated as well. And, there are a number of warnings in the Bible about sort of distrusting quick and visible results. So the difficulty then in evaluative terms is how do you evaluate what has been a successful sermon? 36 people became Christians at the end. That's one measurement, but they're probably not going to likely to happen every Sunday. how do you know that somebody's been nudged forward in their godliness or challenged to change their behavior in that way? So I'm not against the idea of that, because I do think that evaluating our performance and being the best practitioners in what we do and hearing real feedback is really important. But how you actually do it so you sort of relate to what the Bible thinks might be going on in preaching. But I think probably just without leaving aside the formal mechanism, I do think it is, most of you are sort of punters really in terms of receivers of sermons, I'm assuming here. I do encourage you to talk to your preachers and to encourage them. I know that it's quite hard to know what you say to the person who's preached on the way out, other than thank you very much, that was a nice sermon, or whatever. It's quite hard. And actually also, if there's a stream of people going out to suddenly say, you know, point three, and when you made this, so it's quite difficult. But encourage them when they've said something that is positive, and also challenge them. If you think that they've said something in the passage that you don't think is there in the passage, well, most preachers, I think, are very open to a conversation about why they said what they said. They've usually spent hours and hours and hours preparing their sermon, and for anybody to make any reaction to it afterwards, I would say most preachers are generally quite pleased that you've actually engaged with it, because they've got all of the stuff that's in their waste paper bin they never managed to get into the sermon. So if you come and ask them a question about it, they'll be more than happy to give you a little bit of it.
Going back to what you said about women preaching, is that in authority over men or to women preaching to other women? And how does that fit with what Timothy says about a woman not being in authority over a man?
Yep. Right, because we got to the inspiration of the Bible, we got to men and women ministry. So, keep me on several different topics at one time. I mean, longer conversation. But in my own view about how you reconcile, you've got to reconcile the whole of what the New Testament says about men and women's role relationships, not just go to the difficult passages in 1 Timothy. So my question is all preaching exercising authority in the same way? And that's why particularly I think if you take the word prophesy in 1 Corinthians to imply more than just some instantaneous utterance from God, because A, it needs evaluating, and B, it might be that only two or three people can speak that day, perhaps they could come back the next week and finish saying it, whatever. And there is a tradition of prophesying being quite closely tied up with preaching throughout the scriptures. So you've got to hold together the fact the New Testament talks about men and women prophesying. That was the promise that was made in Joel in Acts chapter 2. And at the same time, something about women not exercising authority over men. And I think the way that I think I reconcile that in my mind is that there is some preaching that doesn't have that same authoritative function. And I think the context of 1 Corinthians, 1 Timothy 2 and 3 is more to do with the overall leadership and oversight of a congregation, the exercising authority in that way. But I mean, we can talk afterwards if you like, because there's a much bigger issue, which I think I'd rather spend more time nuancing, to be honest, than to just give you a bald answer between those two texts. But that's how, from a particular preaching context, it seems to me men and women preaching and the authority issue could work out.
On the basis that you only have one chance to make a good first impression, mm-hmm. How much time do you take and concentration on the opening of your sermon when you're preaching?
Yeah, absolutely essential. In my forthcoming book on preaching, I have an illustration from David Cook from Sydney, and he uses a really good illustration I've heard other preachers use as well, but he said it's rather like a plane taking off at Heathrow. If you look at that great big mass of metal and people and you think, how on earth is that going to ever get in the air? And the answer is that actually you have a maximum engine thrust to get you into the air. And then the engines are not working as hard for the whole of the flight time, and then you need a maximum engine thrust to get you back on the ground again. And really that's true of preaching, I think, that actually maximum energy and attention should be given to the beginnings and the ends. And there is, I think, in all of us, and it's true for me, often sitting in the congregation now, that if that preacher is not in some way manage to show a connection between that world of the text and my world early on, then I'm going to struggle to stay with them throughout that. There's one a good book by a chap called Paul Scott Wilson, and he says that once you've done all your work in the passage, you've asked yourself all the questions you need to ask of the text. He said that he calls it the four pages of the sermon. You then need to put your sermon together in this way. First of all, what is the problem in the world that you're dealing with? So what's the issue at stake that this passage might address? Then he takes you to what he calls the problem in the text. What is the issue in the text that might help deal with that? And then he goes to what is the solution in the text to the problem you've outlined, and then applies it to the solution in the text. It's not the only way to do it, but it's quite helpful. I quite often sort of say to the preachers, remember that as a framework, that actually you've got to get the congregation's attention with something that resonates with their world, that you know you've found has been arising from the text that you're at. But your congregation don't necessarily start there. They start with how they see it applying in their world. So, yeah, absolutely. You've got to start where people are at and get the links. And then you've won an audience in order to say, this is how the Bible will help us address this issue.
Thank you for all you've said. You've talked about, basically, I think, taking reasonably or well-educated people, and I hope you'll fall into that category, and learning how to plan and prepare for a sermon, all the paper in the bin, doing it in a structured way and for a set length of time, possibly measuring how good it is, and so on, all of which is great. And yet, and there's been a question on this a bit, we have an example of a man in the New Testament who, for all we know, is actually not very well educated. He hasn't done any planning. He wasn't prepared for this. We don't know what illustrations he gave because we don't know all of what he said necessarily. And yet, off the cuff ad lib, he preached, and there were thousands who came to the Lord that day. Now, that doesn't detract at all from what you said. Can we learn something from that?
Yes.
And that was Peter, by the way.
So I just want to check if I understood your question correctly. So you're saying that the models we have in the New Testament are not always all of highly educated people. What's the value of the education? Or well, I think I'd come back to the question I was asked earlier about gifting. That I do believe that preaching is a spiritual gift. I think there are probably many, not most, intelligent people who could probably stand up and say something insightful for the text. But what I was sort of trying to grasp at really in that survey and in trying to sort of give you all the points that I'm making is that preaching contains all of these things, but it's bigger than that. Because it's got to do with the godliness of the person speaking, it's got to do with the prayerfulness both of the speaker and the hearer. It's got to do with, actually, there is something that the old Puritans spoke about in terms of unction, that actually, that, you know, God in gifting somebody with the Spirit so that they preach in such a way that is heard. So that applies, I think, to any level of gifting, really, insofar as that if there is such a thing as natural ability, then actually, whether it be playing golf or playing the piano or be doing your work business, gifted people tend to be those who also work very hard at it. We shouldn't rely only on natural giftedness, but there should be a sense in which those things are found in the blame and that they're fostered as well. So I don't at all want to give the impression, it's a big challenge of course teaching in Oxford University where we have very intelligent people. I mean, I write a blog which is mostly on preaching, and one of my first ones was on preaching was at the end of my first year. I wrote slightly tongue-in-cheek, but with some serious angst. I said that I'd basically been anxious that I spent a year teaching people how to preach, and I may have made them worse preachers at the end. And the reason why was because I was conscious that I'd spent my time, if you like, filling their toolbox with all of the tools of the trade. And my biggest anxiety is that I'll send them out as jobbing preachers, and all they'd do every time they go to preach is get one of those tools out and to use it. Now, if all I've done is that, then I've actually failed. Because actually it's so much bigger than just teaching the tools of the trade. I mean, you know, if you've been preaching for a while, you can go to a passage and get 3 points out of it, probably all starting with the same letter, and probably tell some stories and get people's attention. But preaching's so much bigger than that, because it's got to do with actually a reliance upon God and a godliness that associates with it, making sure that the passage is absorbed into your own life so you communicate it in that way. So I think I'm basically saying to you, I'm not wanting to undervalue education. You wouldn't expect me to say that, really. But we've got to recognize that, that if somebody's got a gift in this, then training it is going to help it going on.
Well, Simon, thank you very much for an interesting talk. Appreciate it. And can we thank Simon?